funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. The closest I have ever been to the stunning beauty of the Arctic is a view out the window of a commercial jet. I've read a lot about this climate that we now understand is as fragile as it is challenging to survive on the ground. But what makes me feel tied to it are the images I've seen of towering ice formations and alarmingly diminished ice flows, and of wildlife struggling or thriving in a rapidly changing environment. The most memorable images I've ever seen of the Arctic are powerful enough to allow me to imagine I have been there myself, and many of them were made by my guest, photojournalist Paul Nicklin. He was raised on Canada's massive but remote Baffin Island, studied marine biology in college, and has spent most of his professional life creating unforgettable images of this otherworldly environment. Paul Nicklin's 2009 book, Polar Obsession, has just been re-released, and he's in town to speak tonight at the Perot Museum of Nature and Science as part of National Geographic Live. Paul, welcome back to Think.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be back.
There are lots of ways to teach people about science. When did you realize that art was the best way for you to do it?
I think it was when I was a biologist and, you know, we'd be out on the sea ice for, you know, months at a time. We'd come back. We'd have these incredible experiences seeing white wolves eating bearded seals and, you know, polar bears and mothers and cubs, mothers teaching their cubs how to hunt and catch seals. It was really an incredibly beautiful thing to show. But all I could do at that point was put in a checkbox on a sheet of paper, you know, bear catching seal. I came home feeling sort of fairly empty about the experience. And then when we'd share our data, it wasn't very effective. We would, you know, infighting within our own government agency, and other governments wouldn't share their data with us. And it just became very frustrating. And the science is very important. And then I started to think about capturing this with a camera, and then the emotional connection to those images. And then I thought, if I could just get a, you know, a job with National Geographic and reach up to 40 million people with a story, telling them the same information but in a very visual way, and realizing, and then when the first stories came out, there was a huge reaction to them, and I knew that I had found the right sort of calling card to get people to care about the issues that were very important in front of us.
You sent Nat Geo photographs for like 8 years before they finally bought some.
You've done your homework. It's obviously every photographer's dream. And every time I send in a proposal or send them a cover of, you know, some magazine I'd been published in, some smaller magazine, the rejections letters were always the same. And that just made me more hungry and to try much harder. And it wasn't an eight-year process before they finally said, look, you know, you're sort of doing stuff that other people aren't, diving under the ice in extreme conditions and coming back with these images. So they gave me my first story, my first tryout, and it ended up slow start, but ended up going well, and have been there ever since, 15 years now.
What brought your parents to Baffin Island when you were a kid?
My dad was a heavy-duty mechanic in the potash mines of Saskatchewan, and my mom was a school teacher, and they saw an ad for my dad to get a job up there as a mechanic and just thought they'd go up for a year or two of adventure. So they moved to Frobisher Bay, Baffin Island at the time. Now it's called Iqaluit, the place of fish. And we fell in love with it. And my brother did not. He couldn't wait to get out of there fast enough. He didn't like it. It's not for everybody. And for myself, I fell deeply in love with the Arctic. And I've just left there recently. I've been there for 40 years living in the Canadian North.
I've wondered about that, about the people who find it and love it or are born there and never want to leave. And there have to be people who are like, God, just get me to San Diego.
I think so. I think people who don't embrace the cold, who don't embrace big, wide open spaces and nature and sort of different cultures, if it's, you know, if you want your normal 9-to-5 life and coming home to your television and, you know, it's just very raw. It's very wild. It's very different. I mean, we were a minority. We were only three non-Inuit families living in an Inuit community of 190 people with no telephone, no radio, no television. So, you know, it's very raw. And, you know, our toilet was a honey bucket. You know, you have a pail, you know, for your bathroom. And it's just, you know, for some people who really want the full experience, it doesn't bother them at all. You actually really start to get off on the simplicity. It's almost like, compared to today's day and age of, you know, iPhones and computers, it's being there is like being in a constant state of meditation where you're surrounded by the serenity of these wild open spaces. It's really, really powerful.
Humans are not supposed to be evolved to be comfortable in wide open spaces, right? They say that, you know, given a choice, people would much rather go next to a line of trees or through a line of trees than be out in the open. I guess you don't remember a time where that wasn't something that you were experiencing and sort of growing to be comfortable in.
No, I mean, it sort of became my drug was every day to hike up above the town. I didn't like being in schools. I didn't like being around other people. Even though I'm an extrovert, I still wanted to be out. I got my energy from nature. So I would hike outside of our little community, and I'd hike up in the mountains, and I would just sit up there, and I'd watch the light, you know, dance across the sea ice and across the mountains. And, you know, when we weren't there, we were on the Saskatchewan farm and, you know, in Saskatchewan as kids, so they had wide open spaces again. So for myself now, I have a very hard time in confined spaces. Like, New York's a great city, but I'm in full-on panic mode the whole time that I'm there.
Even now, when you're surviving and you're on a shoot, how much of your survival technique is based on like the new high tech gear that is out there and all the polar tech and the special equipment and everything? And how much is influenced by the native families that you grew up with?
I think almost 95% of what I do now, the survival, you know, I say my only great skill that I have as a photographer is I'm better than freezing than anybody else. You know, I'm good at being cold. And also, obviously, with learning from the Inuit, you learn patience. So I think between those two things, being able to be tough and suck it up and to be patient are the two skills that I have. And I think the other skill that I've learned is weather, understanding weather and watching shifting sea ice, for example. I mean, the only time a GPS helped me in one day was when we were sleeping on a sheet of ice on Baffin Island waiting for narwhals to come. And we were on shifts because the ice was breaking up, and the ice drifts out to sea constantly all day long. One day we moved our camps four times in one day, and someone fell asleep on their watch, and I woke up and checked my GPS, and we'd already drifted out to sea a mile and a half. So now we're on a sheet of ice riding out to sea. Luckily, the tide brought it back in. We were able to barely get off this pan of ice. So I think it's those skills learning from the Inuit that are probably 95% that allow me to survive and do what I do.
I was just reading a book last night about a woman who went to the Arctic to study diminishing populations of these birds called red knots. They're like little shorebirds. Yeah. And they had a GPS, and it stopped working because I guess it was too cold or something to function. Have there been times when you felt like, okay, I'm lost, and what do you do with that? Do you take a deep breath and look around? How much can you rely on the light when it maybe the sun doesn't set in quite the same way we're used to it here in the southern part of the globe?
I think that's a great question, a great point. Is, you know, I think that I was just up there with a National Geographic film crew in Greenland 3 days ago, and they had all this high-tech equipment. It was fascinating what they had, but they had this $100,000 drone helicopter, but it wouldn't work because he kept saying, well, North Pole, where's the north? And I said, it's that way. And he goes, well, where's magnetic north? And I said, it's 91 degrees west of us. And he said, well, the chopper can't handle that. So, I mean, so the chopper was panicking the whole time, the drone, because magnetic north was 90 degrees off of true north. And sorry, what was your question?
Just, I guess, the idea of being lost and what you do when you feel like you're lost. Or I don't know how often that's happened.
Yeah, I've been lost a few times. I did a trip in the high Arctic in the 90s, and it was a 3-month solo expedition where I got dropped off in the spring. And I said, pick me up, you know, 3 months later from now, I'll be at the Arctic Ocean where this river meets it. And I did this trip, and I got lost a lot, but and that's where my point was with nature is you really learn to read the environment. You learn to read the sun, and you watch the weather patterns. You look at snow drifts. You know, the prevailing winds might be from the southwest in this area. So you can look at this, you can do almost triangulation between sun and snow drift patterns and even ripples on water. And you can start to triangulate where you are and what direction. I got lost a fair bit, but I loved the challenge of getting back to a base camp, or at least you always have. I've been lost for a couple of days where you have a bug out bag on your back and you can always set up a camp and have a snack and get back to your main. But I've never been lost where I've had to be rescued.
Do you like the literature of, you know, Arctic crews that have gotten iced in? And do you read those stories?
I love those stories.
Shackleton.
You know, obviously Shackleton and Johansson and Amundsen and even Robert Perry. And I was 3 days ago with Robert Perry's great-great-great-grandson on the sea ice. You know, it's just, and these their skills have not diminished at all. These the Inuit are unbelievable. But yeah, I love the stories of shipwrecks and despair and challenges. And, you know, the only one I kick myself for is obviously the Franklin expedition where they just found the ships. But
yeah.
For the last 5 years, I've been having this elder get his grandson to write me write me these emails on Facebook saying, I know where the ships are. I can actually see them underwater through the spring ice. You can see water where there's rotten water. I mean, only an Inuit could be out there on ice that thin. And he says, I know where they are. And I never did, I responded, but I said, I'm busy. And all of a sudden you find out they were found right where he said they were. So, you know, it's using traditional knowledge to go find these things. But yeah, no, I love those stories.
Do you carry a weapon with you?
It depends. You know, it depends on the animal, depends on the situation, depends where I'm going on my 3 months expedition. I brought enough dried food to survive the whole time. If I'm working in polar bear country or grizzly bear country, I might carry something. But if it's generally no. I mean, it's just extra stuff to carry around. I already have 70 pounds of camera equipment, and I don't need the extra weight. But if it's something that's going to, you know, I've seen 3,000 polar bears, 2,000 grizzly bears, and 1,000 black bears probably, and I've never had to kill one, you know, and I'm very proud of that record, you know, and I respect these animals. I listen to these animals. I let them dictate the encounter. I don't have sort of any preconceived notion that I'm friends with them, and, you know, I think that's gotten me a long ways. You hear of Timothy Treadwell and these other disasters, tragedies that have happened, and, you know, you don't want those things to happen.
How do you plan for a shoot when you might, in fact, be waiting weeks for the weather to be right and for, you know, the animal that you really want to study and photograph to appear?
You know, I do a lot of research. I like, you know, in the beginning of National Geographic, they used to ask me to go do stories. You know, when they asked me to go do a story on Atlantic salmon, I was goofy. I said, how many species are there? You know, subspecies, thinking they're like Pacific salmon. Well, there's only one species. There's only one species of Atlantic salmon, obviously. But I took 6 months of research. I had 600 contacts, and it's a lot of work. So I rather now do stories that I'm familiar with, an area that I'm passionate about, like the Arctic or Antarctica, and, you know, like leopard seals that require very little research. And it's, you know, you go down there and jump in the water and come back with some great images.
Very little research, lots of guts.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's guts, but lack of brains.
I mean, you've had really close encounters. After those are over, how do you process what you've just been through when you realize I could have been killed?
Sorry.
After you've had like a brush with something really dangerous, do you just not even think about it until you get back to wherever your permanent home is, or do you have to kind of, take some time?
No, it's the one thing that's really messing me up right now, I think, in my work that is dangerous, is that, you know, when you are in a dangerous situation, your gut, your adrenaline is telling you don't do it. You're gonna die. And psychologically, you have to override that. You have to process through it. And so many times my gut has said, don't do it. And I've thought it through and I do it. And you've had a close call maybe, or maybe it's gone extremely well, or maybe you got hurt. But every time you survive, obviously I'm here. And so that gray area becomes even more gray. It gets bigger and bigger. What's insanity? What's stupidity? What's safe to do? And you're always outside of the safe zone in this stuff. And it's, I really want to come back with these images, especially on climate change issues. I'm extremely passionate about getting very three-dimensional, intimate, close portraits of these species that are at risk. And so I'm always pushing myself to get that really rare moment. And that's got me caught in some bad situations. And that's sort of, so no, I'm usually right after the encounter where something bad has happened, where I know I've pushed it too far, and you just, you know, I've curled up on the ball in the fetal position and cried for half an hour sometimes because I'm so, your adrenaline rush is so big after. But most often, 98% of the time, it goes extremely well, you know, high percentage of the time.
Do you, like, call home after those moments and, you know, talk to your parents or what? I don't know if there's somebody you want to touch base with.
Yeah, recently I did have one where I was diving under the ice in Greenland and I was chasing this big bull walrus, which I shouldn't have been doing in the first place. You know, it's generally one of the most dangerous animals, like a hippo, to be swimming with this bull walrus, and my regulator stopped giving me air and I was 100 feet deep. And if I drop my weight belt, you're stuck up under the ice. And so, you know, I started rocketing to the worst, kicking as hard as I could towards the surface, but I was out of air. I knew I was going to black out. I knew I wasn't going to make it. And if I dump my weight belt, you're going to die under the ice anyway. So on the way up, luckily there must have been like a chunk of ice stuck in my tank that prevented me from getting air, but it released and I got air, and I got to the surface, hit the ice really hard, sort of crawled out from under the ice. And I was just spent, you know, I was really just sort of emotionally raw. And then I phoned my girlfriend, Christina, at the time. And she said, oh, by the way, today, and it was my birthday, actually. She said, by the way, Wes Skiles, who's a good friend of mine with National Geographic, he had just died that day on a rebreather doing a cave story for Geographic. So it really brings that stuff home, you know, really.
Got to jump in here. My guest is photojournalist Paul Nicklin. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
We'll be right back.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is National Geographic photojournalist Paul Nicklin. His 2009 book, Polar Obsession, has just been re-released. He's in town to speak tonight at the Perot Museum of Nature and Science as part of National Geographic Live. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can email think@kera.org. You can send a tweet to me at Chris Boyd Think, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So, Paul, when you hear that a friend has been killed doing similar work, how does that put things in perspective for you, or does it just say, oh, I just got lucky today?
Yeah, I mean, obviously you initially go through, you're incredibly gutted about it. You know, you're really upset losing a friend, and that takes a long time to get over. And then I think more it's a process of denial, like this won't happen to me, you know, and you just keep going. I mean, when I started photography, I loved to take pretty pictures and see them in magazines. And then all of a sudden you get into storytelling, and then you get into journalism, and then you get into issues you really care about. And it's like, nothing's going to stop me from pushing hard on these issues now. And, you know, if you don't want to be a cowboy, you don't want to die in the process. But you know, you can't take pictures when you're dead and tell stories when you're dead. But at the same time, you know, there's such an urgency to what we're doing now. I've just started an organization called Sea Legacy, and we're launching 45 expeditions over the next 10 years to keep telling these stories. You know, National Geographic's fantastic, but the pace is too slow for me. When I start to see, you know, this summer on a Sea Legacy expedition, a donor came with us, and, you know, we got to see firsthand polar bears that were starving to death, that were dead on the shores of Svalbard, where traditionally they're very, very healthy. And, you know, all of a sudden that just drives you and fuels you, and you're not sitting there thinking, well, am I worried about my safety, or should I slow down, or how do I be more safe? You're thinking, I got to tell these stories now, and I got to share them with the world now.
When did you first begin to notice that something was changing about these environments that you were so familiar with?
You know, I think where I'm really lucky is that I already had the jump on. You know, you think of the polar regions, are some areas in the Arctic are melting 20 weeks earlier every year. There's less ice and less healthy ice for 20 weeks. That's almost, you know, that's almost half a year. The huge effects on the wildlife populations. But that's been really noticed in the last 10 to 15 years, where I was on a trip 17 years ago with some of the top scientists, and everybody said, we think there's some problem. You know, we're looking at the submarine data. The ice is a lot less thin, but, you know, we don't want to stick our names on it yet. And now every one of those scientists I can talk to, and I'd say 7 years ago, the science was, there's major change happening. It's negative. You know, ice is way down. We're worried about the future. And now it's, hey, we're probably going to lose polar bears in the next 100 years. It's sort of happened that fast in the last 10 years. The Arctic's going to be void of ice in the next 4 to 15 years during the summer months. You know, like I said, 20 weeks less of ice for polar bears and other species to use. Almost every species in the Arctic and Antarctica depend on healthy sea ice.
Can you explain why polar bears need that ice and what it has to do with their ability to hunt for food and to sort of just get through the cycle of a normal year?
Sure. I mean, I think what is important is to start break it down into the whole ecosystem, and that's what makes a lot more sense for polar bears. Is every year you have annual ice and you have multi-year ice, and that's ice that lives for many years. When the sun returns to the Arctic and Antarctica in the spring, you get photosynthesis, you get phytoplankton, you get the zooplankton, and that grows underneath the ice, and people don't see that, out of sight, out of mind, and it's like this inverted garden, and it's beautiful to see. You've got the copepods and amphipods, and you've got the polar cod feeding on them. You've got the seals, the ring seals and the bearded seals, and the ring seals live in these little igloos, these little holes in the ice where they give birth to their pups. You've got harp seals that give birth to their pups on the ice. You've got beluga whales and narwhals and all these animals that feed on this life that's generated from this icy ecosystem. And then on top of that, you've got the polar bear that needs the ice in order to hunt from this icy platform. You know, they can swim very well. The big fat bears can, you know, the big healthy bears. But the skinny bears, the young bears, the cubs, you know, they're going to get hypothermia like we would if they're in the water too long. So these bears need ice in order to hunt from to catch seals. Sure, they can catch eggs, you know, eat eggs, or they can catch a bird on a bird cliff, but that's not enough to sustain themselves. That's like, you know, me having a peanut saying, okay, I'm fine now. You know, it's, you know, they need that ice in order to hunt.
What do you do? It seems like the one problem with the kind of work that you do that shows people these images that are beautiful, sometimes they are haunting, It's hard for people to see those things and then connect those to the choices they make every day about what kind of car to drive, what sort of diet to eat, you know, how much air conditioning and heating their house needs. Have you figured out a way to help us all understand that there is a link?
I'm working on it. You know, as I obviously was a scientist and that wasn't working for me, I felt ineffective. And then, you know, I think it was 2007 for National Geographic. I did that's what I just explained to you about the levels of the ecosystem connected to the ice. I said to Geographic, can I write an emotional plea to your readers, you know, in your magazine and show images about these species I care about in this habitat? And they sort of laughed at me and they said, well, that's not really what we do. And then they finally said, go ahead. You know, it was a new editor, Chris Johns, fantastic friend of mine, editor in chief. And we did the story and I was really nervous. I'm like, what have I done? You know, I'm going to get lambasted, you know, by the hardcore journalism community. You don't usually write emotional pleas, really, and explain about my life in the North and why this stuff matters. And well, that story came back and it got the highest readership score of any previous story in 14 years in National Geographic magazine. And I was just like, okay, now I'm on to something. You know, if you're showing people the worst of every situation all the time, they turn off, you know. So that's why I'm loving social media now. I love Instagram. You know, I have, Geographic has 18 million followers. I have close to 1 million followers. And what a great opportunity now to use beautiful photography sometimes. You know, I put up the graphic stuff. I've put up the dead polar bears on these sites and people write me very sad emails and they connect and other people say, stop your propaganda, bears are fine. You know, so you get these debates going between people. And I think we're at a very exciting time being able to reach the world with issues that are important.
What do we do for the species that are not so visually appealing as bears and penguins, things that people can see and say, I don't want those to go away? There are, you know, animals that we don't find cute.
I know. I'm always frustrated with that. It's one issue. But I mean, I used to frustrate me a lot when you think people are like, they have to save the baby harp seals because they are white, fluffy and cute. And the fact that they're clubbed and, you know, it is tragic to watch. It is sad. It is gut-wrenching to see and to hear about. But that population is doing extremely well. It's rocketing, you know, and polar bears do well because they're cute. But, you know, we don't care. You think about half the amphibians on this planet are supposed to disappear in the next 10 to 15 years. I mean, but they're not cute. They're not beautiful. So we don't really focus on that too much. So I have friends of mine like Joel Sartori, who's doing a project called Photo Arc, where he's photographing all these lesser-known species and less beautiful species. And so, I mean, for myself, it's not so much about species, but it's more about ecosystems. So I'll use a cute animal like a baby harp seal or a polar bear or, you know, whatever to lure people into the issue. And then I'll present the issue to them. So I feel almost guilty sometimes. I'm like baiting in these teenagers on Instagram with this really beautiful picture. And they look, oh, it's so cute. And then, boom, you hit them with a heavy climate change message. So it's what I feel I have to do to get the message across.
It must be interesting on Instagram because you can see all those teenagers communicating with one another about what you've put up there.
And that's what I love. I mean, I'm not so interested. You know, I can put up a picture on National Geographic this morning and it already has 500,000 likes, which is great, but I don't care about that so much. If it doesn't get comments, it needs, for me, comments, and then better than comments is debate. And when people start to debate, you know, first of all, like I'll show them people like, I didn't know that narwhals exist, for example, when I put up a picture of a narwhal, and then they all start to quote the movie Elf. Goodbye, buddy. Hope you find your dad. I guess that was in the movie Elf. So I only know that quote because I see it every time when I put up a narwhal. But then people start to learn, well, you realize that they need deep polar cod and they need ice, and, you know, the polar cod need ice. And you start to see people sort of regurgitating this information that they're learning. And it's very rewarding. You realize you're getting through to people on this stuff.
By the way, we have some great examples of Paul's work on the KERA Think Tumblr page, so you can check those out there. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or you can email think@kera.org. I want to talk about this thing that you raised about debates because, you know, scientists sometimes will debate things among themselves, but they all come to it with scientific knowledge. It seems that what we have now is a debate between science and people who really don't understand science. And I don't know quite how you tell that story without giving equal weight to the people who have a great deal of knowledge and the people who don't.
And I think that's sort of where I feel my role is, where we come in as storytellers and journalists, is you know, that was my frustration with scientists. Often the best scientists I ever worked with, the most intelligent, the most, you know, professional, were the worst communicators because they're so left brain analytical into their projects. And so I try and bring out the right side, you know, reach people through their right side of their brain, through visual communication, through the beauty, through the issues, through visual. I think we really are a visual communicating species. You think back to the cave days where they're painting on cave walls, you know, and it's, I think we get that. And I always find that that's my role in this disconnect that you're talking about. It is a very frustrating disconnect. I think the bigger problem is, you know, I often think on climate change, nothing's really going to happen until the United States takes a global leadership role, for example. You know, everyone's sort of waiting to see what the U.S. is going to do. And, of course, Canada's busy, you know, with our tar sands, and China's putting in 2 coal plants a week. And so the U.S. has got to take a role, and it's a role in this. But there's so much – it's such a polarized country on this. You know, you're either for it or against it, and it's not. It's an issue that affects all of us, and it's – we all have to get involved.
Of course, there are many countries in the world, or a number of them, that have, you know, land or territory in the polar region that would love to see an open sea route every year.
Absolutely. An open sea route, and they can, I think, 2,000 miles shorter distance travel than the Panama Canal, easier traffic for their ships. You know, there's oil opportunities, there's mineral opportunities, and that's the stuff that gets me pretty down and out. When rather than people saying, hey, you know, this is our planet, we all live here, you know, rather than alarm bells going off, people seeing this as an opportunity, especially when we're talking about an oversurplus of oil. And then, I mean, when you hear of California having its water shortages, and then you hear that 70 million gallons of water were used for fracking in California, you shake your head on these disconnects. It's frustrating, you know. So it's but you got to keep pushing forward. You got to keep telling these stories and showing these pictures of these places. I mean, I was up working with bowhead whales. An endangered species in the Canadian Arctic was just delisted. And one boat came off a ship and came into this bay where we'd been working with only kayaks. It displaced all 80 whales from their breeding ground for 2 weeks before they came back. Just one little motor, like we're talking a 70-horsepower motor. And you think, what's going to happen when big tankers and ships start trucking through these areas? You know, what's it going to do to these wildlife populations?
You worked in the Antarctic as well?
I've worked a lot in Antarctica as well. And yeah, I work both polar regions almost equally.
How different is the experience from one to the other? For those of us who have not been there, I mean, obviously there's land beneath one and not beneath the other. But can you talk about the things that strike you as this is very much the same, and the things that feel very different?
I think the similarity is that they're both life-changing, stunning, beautiful places to visit. I mean, it's the most beautiful places to me on the planet. The differences are, in the Arctic, species are generally heavily hunted, so everything is scared. You know, to get a picture of a polar bear, I'll have to wait a month or a few weeks, or, you know, it's, and when you're there, you're with telephoto lenses and you're, you know, trying different creative ways to get close, which some places, ways I'll show tonight in my talk. But you go to Antarctica and nothing's afraid of you. You know, you jump in the water and leopard seals are trying to force feed you penguins, or elephant seals are coming up to you, or penguins are hopping on your lap because they want to take a nap on your hot legs while you're sitting down, you know, to sit on a rock because your lap's more comfortable than a rock. I mean, it's just that way. It's incredibly different. And then I think the other difference is people look at Antarctica and say, well, no, the ice is fine, because you look at the sea ice and it's not retreating as fast as the Arctic. But if you look at the ice caps of Antarctica, like the Larsen B ice shelf, that's completely disappeared. We're talking an area of ice that's 1,000 feet thick, as bigger than the area of California, gone in 20 years. Other areas are breaking up with the ice caps. It's a sign of a melting habitat. And you think of Greenland, the first time last year is the first time on record that the entire ice cap is melting. You know, the pictures I have from these places of just water gushing out of these ice caps is, you know, you talk about seawater rise, you see it happening, the water coming into the ocean. I mean, they're just different that way.
How are humans adapting in these places, in the Arctic at least, who have, you know, traditionally been able to get everything they needed to eat from the land, and maybe now things are changing, and from the sea?
Well, it's funny because I was just in Greenland 2 days ago, 3 days ago, just coming home from there, working with the Kanak Greenland. And this is up in the northwest. We're talking 80 degrees north, 600 miles from the North Pole where they live. And I was out with, you know, like I said, Robert Perry's great-great-grandson and his uncle and the family. And these people are like polar bears. They everything they get is from the sea ice. They get their clothing from the ice. You know, they get seals and they are their food. And, you know, polar bears can't articulate what they're feeling and thinking. And, you know, they can't say, well, I had, you know, better luck 10 years ago with catching seals. But the Inuit can. And everywhere we went, by traveling by dog team, they kept saying, we can't go there anymore. We can no longer cross to Baffin Island. We can no longer cross to Ellesmere Island. We can't get seals there anymore. When I was a kid, we used to have our camp over there. We can't get there anymore. The ice is thinner. It's melting earlier. It's freezing later. We have a shorter hunting season. We don't understand the way the ice is breaking up. We don't understand. You know, they're so in tune with their environment that they're you look at the sadness in their eyes, and it's as you see them sort of retreat from this life back into their homes where they're it's not natural for them. You know, they really belong out there. You see them light up, and they're very connected. I mean, to that world, and it's very sad that their culture is so tied to that and will disappear with the loss of ice as well.
When you meet an Inuit person who doesn't know how you grew up and that you have a familiarity with the language and the culture, and you open your mouth and speak, are they? What's the reaction?
I think in Greenland just now they would just laugh at me when I would try to speak Inuktitut because it's such a different dialect. It's like it's completely different. There is some overlap, but I think they appreciated that I was trying. But it's very heartwarming. You know, I realize I'll never be Inuit, but I like it that I can hang out with them. And, you know, you sit down and you eat uyuk, you eat their soup, and I love their open door policy in the communities. You just walk into any house and there's usually a dead caribou on the floor and some, you know, you sit down and have a piece of meat and then they start to tell you stories, you know, and it's really nice to be sort of welcomed into the culture. But, yeah.
Do their kids want iPhones and video games and all that now?
Yeah, it's pretty gut-wrenching to watch. It's, you know, they dream of, they see L.A. and New York on television, and they dream of that. I'll say, what are your dreams? And they're sitting there in this pristine habitat with narwhals swimming by and, you know, birds flying over them and these bird migrations, and it's just a beautiful day. And they're like, their dream is to, you know, to go to L.A. and to see, you know, Justin Bieber live in a concert. You know, it's like you just want to. tell them how special it is. Where they live is it's sort of the last ice. It's really the last sort of really pristine habitat, and you see what's going on in the Amazon and other places on the globe, and it's we need to cherish these places.
Do the Inuit, do they make a lot of art? And I wonder how they convey their emotional attachment to the landscape and how they've preserved that feeling over time.
I think their art is like none other. It's stunning. I mean, in my house, it's full of Inuit art, you know, as far as soapstone carvings. And I love it that they're such visual storytellers. And I think that's where I got my passion for what I do is as a kid, everything was visual. The kids in the evening in Inuktitut, they would tell ghost stories. And we would talk about Kadlupidlu, the sea monster she would come up. She wears this anamauti in Inuk Parka where, you know, women carry their babies. And she'd come up from the depths and grab you and take you down underwater and drown you and eat you. And I just love the storytelling. And the art's very, very, very powerful. But they haven't started doing environmental art yet.
We're speaking this hour with wildlife photojournalist Paul Nicklin. He shoots a lot for National Geographic. He has a book, Polar Obsession, which has just been re-released. He's in town to speak tonight at the Perot Museum of Nature and Science as part of National Geographic Live. You can see some great examples of his work on the KERA Think Tumblr page. We'll be back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with wildlife photojournalist Paul Nicklin, who is in town to speak tonight at the Perot Museum of Nature and Science as part of National Geographic Live. You can check out his work on the KERA Think Tumblr page. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. So you founded this organization, Sea Legacy, and you are trying to, you know, find even more ways to spread the word about things. Do you still think it's possible for us to reverse the escalation of climate change?
I think we're, you know, you talk to any, you know, these aren't just emotional answers. This is me communicating with the top scientists in the world, you know, talking with top NASA scientists and NOAA scientists. And, you know, obviously we're past the turning point. We are going to lose species. We are going to lose a lot of habitat. There is going to be, you know, major irreversible damage. But my whole goal is for people not to react when, say, the streets of New York are being flooded, you know, from rising sea levels in 150 years from now. I mean, the fact that we're even sort of having this debate still is shocking to me. And the sooner we react, the less the fallout and the loss is going to be. And, you know, I don't want us to just start reacting once we start realizing the major effects on our species. You know, it's all the other species that sort of are under our under our care. And it's sort of, we're custodians of this planet, and we must, you know, sort of treat it accordingly and take care of it.
Does there come a point where you just have to stop being polite when somebody expresses something that you know to be scientifically inaccurate, but they formed a whole opinion about it?
Yeah, I think originally when I was so emotional about it, I'd just come back from a trip photographing a bunch of dead bears, you know, that had starved to death, and, you know, seeing that this summer, and people like, well, climate change isn't real, get over it, you know. And I just realized that, you know, when you think about the ultimate, I think that's the genius. I didn't see it at the time, but the genius of Al Gore's title, An Inconvenient Truth. It is a huge inconvenience to care about this. And if you have to start altering your way of life, if you have to, you know, start flying economy, or, you know, maybe not use your Learjet as much, or have your third house, or, you know, I mean, it's just major change is coming. And it's how much do we want to inconvenience ourselves now to sort of mitigate or minimize the amount of change we're going to have to do later.
But even, you know, when you take it and you talk about the Learjet and the third house, for most of us, though, you know, we can look at that and say, well, I don't do that. I have one house and I have one car. And I mean, there is this question of how you let people know that it's all of us. It's not just the fat cats.
I think, you know, yeah, exactly. And I think when I meet real strong deniers, I just realize that you're not going to get through to everybody. And ultimately, you don't need to get through to everybody. You know, you need change. You need governments to make decisions and vote and to make major changes and force policies. You know, so, I mean, to even hear the Pope last week mention climate change is now, you know, that's exciting. We're moving in the right direction. We're just, everything is happening. It's just happening a little bit too slowly and not major enough, you know. So it's happening, though.
You were mentored as a young photographer by Flip Nicklin, whose name is spelled differently, who is not a relative. What is the balance when that sort of relationship happens between the senior professional sort of remaking someone else in his own image or her own image and helping you to discover what your style is and where you will go with your career?
I think that was, you know, when I started working with Flip, it was... I'd already published a book, and I'd been published in most magazines around the world. But where I was failing, and flailing, is journalism and storytelling. And it was, you know, it's funny when he took me under his wings, and Joel Sartori also helped me in the U.S. as well. I've had two great mentors. You know, neither of them ever sat there and said, "This photo's not very good. If you do this, it'll be a better picture." What they did is this is how you tell a story. And this is, you know, so you break down storytelling through visual communication. And those were the best lessons they ever could have taught me. So whenever I mentor young photographers now or I work with them, I help them. It's about storytelling and it's about getting a message out there. It's not so much about, you know, you assume that they can take a good photo or at least they're working towards that. And, you know, finding your own style. I mean, my own style is I want people to care. So that's sort of working back for some of that. My images have to be incredibly close. They have to be intimate. They can't be shot through a 600 millimeter lens. If I want a picture of a polar bear, it's got to be through a 17 millimeter lens. It's got to be ultra wide. So often I'm using camera traps or remotes, or I'll let the bear take its own picture. But it has to be intimate. Whether it's, you know, walrus under the ice, it has to be intimate. You know, so that's my style now. See, they call me the underwater street photographer. You know, so.
Camera traps have to be fun when you go back and discover what you have, if there's anything there. I would imagine sometimes there's, you know, you've set it up beautifully and nothing happens.
There are guys like Nick Nichols and Drew Rush and friends of mine who I work with who are masters at it, and I don't have the patience to spend weeks. There's no emotional connection. I love the animals. That's why I got into this. I love the encounters, you know, walking with that spirit bear through the forest for 2 days and being, you know, 3 feet away from it and watching it, you hearing it eat skunk cabbage, then catching a fish and then having a nap. And while it's breathing and snoring and sleeping, I'm sitting right there with a super wide angle lens taking pictures of it. And I love that stuff. That's what I get off on. That's my drug in this profession. And so, you know, it's camera traps for me. And no matter how good the image is, it's like, okay, well, I guess there's a good picture on there, you know. So it's not that real emotional connection that I look for in the work I do.
You said earlier that you are an extrovert, but you spend a lot of time on your own working.
I do. I mean, it's funny. I love it. I love being alone. I love people. I don't like being around a lot of people, but I get my energy from being alone. I really get my charge from being in nature, from being out alone in nature, sitting on hillsides, going for walks, diving alone, free diving, swimming, sitting on islands. I mean, maybe I'm a little weird that way, but maybe it comes from my childhood. But I just love, it's for me, it's like my form of meditation. When I'm around people, my brain's firing and I'm sort of exhausted and I'm sort of scattered and, you know, computers and emails and iPhones and texts, and it drives me crazy, you know, but it's an important part of the world we're in today. But it is a beautiful meditative state to be out alone in nature. It's where I recharge my batteries for sure.
Are you the sort of person who does what if thinking? Like, do you ever imagine, like, what if I'd been raised in Toronto?
That's a good question. I don't think I do. You know, I just sort of wake up every day and give thanks and follow my heart and go out and chase it. And I don't ask myself that a lot.
Whose Instagrams do you follow?
I really do follow. My favorite is National Geographic's because 18 million followers. Obviously, it's really popular. I like the messages. I like the storytelling. I like the quality of photographers. You know, my peers like John Stanmeyer and Corey Richards and Joel. And those are the guys. You know, every year at National Geographic, we have this annual seminar. And it's they show their latest work, their projects they're passionate about. And that fuels my batteries for another year's work where I go out and push even harder and try and shoot better and do better things and tell better stories. You know, friends of mine like Jimmy Chin, who, you know, not only does he go to the top of Everest, but he carries his skis on his back in a backpack to the top of Everest, gets to the summit, no oxygen, puts on his skis, and not only skis down the mountain, but he photographs other people skiing down the mountain while he's at it. Those are the people I just sort of shake my head, and I'm so in awe of them, and they're humble, kind, encouraging people, and we're sort of this family of people who push each other. So I love going on their Instagram every day and just and seeing what other people are up to.
How often do you have to replace your gear?
I'm really hard on my gear. My gear is not important to me. I have no, when I used to buy cameras as a kid, I would, you know, put it up on a mantle and take it by to my bedside table and watch it and, you know, look at it in the morning and just like, you know, but it's just very much tools that I'm willing to destroy and wreck. I lost $25,000 worth of camera gear off the side of my boat this summer. It's like, oh, okay, well, there it goes. And, you know, I have insurance, but you get more gear and you keep doing your work. So, yeah.
Do you do you sail for recreation or what do you do when you have downtime?
You know, it's funny. When I'm in the field, I get really out of shape because you're in really, really cold environments. You're eating fatty foods. So when I come home, I need to work out. And so often for me, that's road biking or I love mountain biking. Again, you're all alone. You're on a bike. You're in nature. You know, there's bears on the trails and, you know, the odd cougar and birds. And it's just this beautiful ride. And your endorphins are going. And it's, you know, a good 2-3 hour ride with these big climbs and these beautiful vistas at the top of the climb. So I love mountain biking is my new big one.
If everyone had the means, is there an ideal image size for the photographs that you take? Like, would you like everybody to see them in, you know, 5 feet by 7 feet, knowing that so many people are going to experience them on a screen that is 4 inches?
I think that's where I'm headed now is, you know, I love National Geographic magazine. I love the social media world, but I'm going back in time and we're producing these with us under Sea Legacy. We're doing 3 major projects. We're doing the polar regions, we're doing temperate seas, and we're doing tropical seas and working towards conservation, marine protected areas, you know, fisheries reform, coastal communities. But for each one, I'm very excited about the thought of major exhibitions with really large, beautiful prints, fine art prints with the best printers in New York, doing coffee table books that are going to be almost 2 feet by 3 feet, these massive books that you need to stand. And you can just lose yourself in these big, beautiful prints and these beautiful books. And I'm excited about, I love like speaking at the Pearl Museum tonight is, I'm very excited about, they have a big screen. I love to see this stuff big and you can sort of lose yourself in it. And I really enjoy that. So I love to see stuff big.
Do you shoot a lot of video or are you still mostly doing still work?
I'm really leaning towards video now because, again, it's that emotional connection. A good friend of mine, Gregory Colbert, who did Ashes and Snow, who I work a lot with, you know, he'll sit down and say, oh, here's some stuff I just shot on his Epic Red, you know, on slow motion. And it's just you on 90 frames a second. And it's just, you know, you're under the water with this whale. And it's just, I find myself just starting to cry sometimes. It's so powerful. And I'm always looking to create that connection. So we are really starting to, now with the new cameras that you can shoot 4K, 6K, 8K, and, you know, cinematic quality of these beautiful things. Now I'm excited about shooting video. So we're really making that move as well towards video. Sea Legacy is about making 3 big films as well as these other exhibitions and books as well.
How do you decide who you want to work with?
I just work with really nice people, you know, and, you know, people are obviously who are talented and passionate, but I really love nice people. You know, you want to enjoy your time in nature. I don't want to be with big production film crews where there's this pecking order and people aren't nice to each other. I need people who are passionate, driven, focused, talented, and just really excited to be involved.
How can you tell when you have changed someone's mind?
oh, it's easy. They usually come and tell me. I mean, they were like, I didn't know that. Now I finally believe. And I have, you know, that's what probably keeps me going is I get 20 emails a day or on Facebook saying, I had no idea. Now I believe. Now I get it. Thanks for painting this picture. Thanks for explaining it so well. I get it now. And I love when people say, I get it. And then when people start to actually make change in their personal lives and they start to tell me about that and, you know, with simple ways that they're changing themselves. I even had recently a four-year-old kid. I spoke to a kindergarten class or a pre-care class and went home and chewed his parents out that they had ice in their freezer, that they had stolen it from the polar bears. And I just thought it's cute. You know, it's just fun, but it's and I've even had Jay Inslee, governor of Washington, you know, tell him one day I saw all my pictures being painted online and he was him who was painting my work. And then he had to come to Capitol Hill and speak to his team because he was so passionate about the changing Arctic. And so that, you know, it's good.
You feel like millennials get this because they've been hearing about it since they were in kindergarten?
I think millennials get it because they're angry. It's we've created this mess for them. You know, we should have been taking care of this a long time ago, especially when we started learning about climate change 15, 20 years ago and started sort of, we should have jumped on that right away. That the fact that we're still having this debate and they're like, you're leaving us with this mess. And kids are angry. And I mean, that's where I love these kids are fired up. And they're the voters who are going to be voting very soon. So, I mean, that gives me a sense of hope as well.
What do you say to people who are thinking about studying science, but they're afraid that there's only one path that they can take?
You know, it's funny. I was a terrible student at University of Victoria where I went to school and I was a disaster.
They love you now though.
Yeah, I was a disaster and you know, I barely passed my classes and I would, instead of studying for an exam that, you know, I would go out and go diving, night diving instead and, you know, fail the exam, barely get a D in the course. And so it was very weird that recently, you know, they called me, the dean of science had come down, I want to talk to you. And I thought for sure they were going to revoke my degree saying you didn't have enough credits. And he said, by the way, we're giving you a lifetime achievement award for your work on climate change. I almost fell over. I was shocked. You know, I was very touched. So I really just encourage people not to put so much pressure on themselves, you know, to really follow their heart and really, there's this beautiful journey of life and to go out and you know, chase it down, but don't listen to everybody around you. Don't listen to my dad who told me I had to be an engineer, you know, and, you know, that was a real job. And, you know, now he was so against me being a photographer, you know, and then all of a sudden he had all my prints hanging on his walls. You know, it's you just got to follow your own path, follow your own dream and realize that it's like the Dow Jones. It's going to be up and down for sure. But enjoy the downs as well. You know, don't be so hard on yourself.
Your work is clearly mission-driven, but I wonder if there is a particular image that you know you will someday get that you just really dream about, something just ideal.
It's funny. I get that question all the time. And I'd say a year ago that would be, you know, swimming with orcas and filming a big pod of orcas underwater. Well, we just did a story. A donor paid for us through Sea Legacy to go do this this diving expedition up in Norway. And so we were swimming one night. We had 600 orcas in this fjord and just slipping into the water and have 20 orcas coming right up to me from me to, you know, 3 feet away. And it's just, that was incredibly powerful. But I'm always pinching myself. Am I getting to live this life that I'm never too focused on what's coming next? But sure, you know, diving under the Antarctic ice and in the Ross Sea and making a difference with those images and, you know, swimming with blue whales and sperm whales. And most of all, I'm more excited about continuing to connect ecosystems for people and create this visual connection.
Photojournalist Paul Nicklin is in town to speak tonight at the Perot Museum of Nature and Science as part of National Geographic Live. His book, Polar Obsession, has just been re-released. Paul, it is always a pleasure. Thank you for making time for us.
Thanks so much for having me. Great to be back.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today and many days over the past several months from our intern, Kristen Taylor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.